This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Caitlin Sticko, 2006. A Vindication of the Rights of Woman by Mary Wollstonecraft. Section 13.3. Ignorance, and the mistaken cunning that nature sharpens in weak heads as a principle of self-preservation, render women very fond of dress, and produce all the vanity which such a fondness may naturally be expected to generate, to the exclusion of emulation and magnanimity. I agree with Rousseau that the physical part of the art of pleasing consists in ornaments, and for that very reason I should guard girls against the contagious fondness for dress so common to weak women, that they may not rest in the physical part. Yet weak are the women who imagine they can long please without the aid of the mind, or, in other words, without the moral art of pleasing. But the moral art, if it be not a profanation to use the word art when alluding to the grace which is an effect of virtue and not the motive of action, is never to be found with ignorance. The sportiveness of innocence, so pleasing to refined libertines of both sexes, is widely different in its essence from this superior gracefulness. A strong inclination for external ornaments ever appears in barbarous states. Only the men, not the women, adorn themselves. For where women are allowed to be so far on a level with men, society has advanced at least one step in civilization. The attention to dress, therefore, which has been thought a sexual propensity, I think natural to mankind. But I ought to express myself with more precision. When the mind is not sufficiently opened to take pleasure in reflection, the body will be adorned with sedulous care, and ambition will appear in tattooing or painting it. So far is the first inclination carried that even the hellish yoke of slavery cannot stifle the savage desire of admiration which black heroes inherit from both their parents, for all the hardly earned savings of a slave are commonly expended in a little tawdry finery, and I have seldom known of a good male or female servant that was not particularly fond of dress. Their clothes were their riches, and I argue from analogy that the fondness for dress, so extravagant in females, arises from the same cause, want of cultivation of mind. When men meet, they converse about business, politics, or literature. But, says Swift, quote, "how naturally do women apply their hands to each other's lappets and ruffles," end quote. And very natural it is, for they have not any business to interest them, have not a taste for literature, and they find politics dry, because they have not acquired a love for mankind, by turning their thoughts to the grand pursuits that exalt the human race and promote general happiness. Besides, various are the paths to power and fame, which by accident or choice men pursue, and though they jostle against each other, for men of the same profession are seldom friends, yet there is a much greater number of their fellow-creatures with whom they never clash. But women are very differently situated with respect to each other, for they are all rivals. Before marriage it is their business to please men, and after, with a few exceptions, they follow the same scent with all the persevering pertinacity of instinct. Even virtuous women never forget their sex in company, for they are ever trying to make themselves agreeable. A female beauty and a male wit appear to be equally anxious to draw the attention of the company to themselves, and the animosity of contemporary wits is proverbial. Is it then surprising that when the sole ambition of women centres in beauty, and interest gives vanity additional force, perpetual rivalships should ensue? They are all running the same race, and would rise above the virtue of mortals if they did not view each other with a suspicious and even envious eye. An immoderate fondness for dress, for pleasure, and for sway, are the passions of savages, the passions that occupy those uncivilized beings who have not yet extended the dominion of the mind, or even learned to think with the energy necessary to concatenate that abstract train of thought which produces principles, and that women, from their education and the present state of civilized life, are in the same condition, cannot, I think, be controverted. To laugh at them, then, or satirize the follies of a being who is never allowed to act freely from the light of her own reason, is as absurd as cruel, for that they who are taught blindly to obey authority will endeavor cunningly to elude it, is most natural and certain. Yet let it be proved that they ought to obey men implicitly, and I shall immediately agree that it is a woman's duty to cultivate a fondness for dress in order to please, and a propensity to cunning for her own preservation. The virtues, however, which are supported by ignorance, must ever be wavering. The house built on sand could not endure a storm. It is almost unnecessary to draw the inference. If women are to be made virtuous by authority, which is a contradiction in terms, let them be immured in seraglios and watched with a jealous eye. Fear not that the iron will enter into their souls, for the souls that can bear such treatment are made of yielding materials, just animated enough to give life to the body. Quote, matter too soft, a lasting mark to bear, and best distinguished by black, brown, or fair. End quote. The most cruel wounds will, of course, soon heal, and they may still people the world and dress to please men. All the purposes which certain celebrated writers have allowed that they were created to fill. Section 13.4. Women are supposed to possess more sensibility, and even humanity, than men, and their strong attachments and instantaneous emotions of compassion are given as proofs. But the clinging affection of ignorance has seldom anything noble in it, and may mostly be resolved into selfishness, as well as the affection of children and brutes. I have known many weak women whose sensibility was entirely engrossed by their husbands, and as for their humanity, it was very faint indeed, or rather, it was only a transient emotion of compassion. Humanity does not consist in a squeamish ear, says an eminent orator. It belongs to the mind as well as the nerves. But this kind of exclusive affection, though it degrade the individual, should not be brought forward as a proof of the inferiority of the sex, because it is the natural consequence of confined views. For even women of superior sense, having their attention turned to little employments and private plans, rarely rise to heroism, unless when spurred on by love. And love as a heroic passion, like genius, appears but once in an age. I therefore agree with the moralist who asserts, quote, that women have seldom so much generosity as men, end quote, and that their narrow affections, to which justice and humanity are often sacrificed, render the sex apparently inferior, especially as they are commonly inspired by men. But I contend that the heart would expand as the understanding gained strength, if women were not depressed from their cradles. I know that a little sensibility and great weakness will produce a strong sexual attachment, and that reason must cement friendship. Consequently, I allow that more friendship is to be found in the male than female world, and that men have a higher sense of justice. The exclusive affections of women seem indeed to resemble Cato's most unjust love for his country. He wished to crush Carthage, not to save Rome, but to promote its vain glory. And in general, it is to similar principles that humanity is sacrificed, for genuine duties support each other. Besides, how can women be just or generous when they are the slaves of injustice? Section 13.5. As the rearing of children, that is, the laying a foundation of sound health, both of body and mind, in the rising generation, has justly been insisted on as the peculiar destination of woman, the ignorance that incapacitates them must be contrary to the order of things. And I contend that their minds can take in much more, and ought to do so, or they will never become sensible mothers. Many men attend to the breeding of horses, and overlook the management of the stable, who would, strange want of sense and feeling, think themselves degraded by paying any attention to the nursery. Yet how many children are absolutely murdered by the ignorance of women! But when they escape, and are neither destroyed by unnatural negligence nor blind fondness, how few are managed properly with respect to the infant mind! So that to break the spirit allowed to become vicious at home, a child is sent to school, and the methods taken there, which must be taken to keep a number of children in order, scatter the seeds of almost every vice in the soil thus forcibly torn up. I have sometimes compared the struggles of these poor children, who ought never to have felt restraint, nor would, had they been always held in with an even hand, to the despairing plunges of a spirited filly, which I have seen breaking on a strand, its feet sinking deeper and deeper in the sand every time it endeavoured to throw its rider, till at last it sullenly submitted. I have always found horses, an animal I am attached to, very tractable when treated with humanity and steadiness, so that I doubt whether the violent methods taken to break them do not essentially injure them. I am, however, certain that a child should never be thus forcibly tamed after it has injudiciously been allowed to run wild, for every violation of justice and reason in the treatment of children weakens their reason. And so early do they catch a character that the base of their moral character, experience leads me to infer, is fixed before their seventh year, the period during which women are allowed the sole management of children. Afterwards, it too often happens that half the business of education is to correct, and very imperfectly it is done, if done hastily, the faults which they would never have acquired if their mothers had had more understanding. One striking instance of the folly of women must not be omitted. The manner in which they treat servants in the presence of children, permitting them to suppose that they ought to wait on them and bear their humours. A child should always be made to receive assistance from a man or woman as a favour, and as the first lesson of independence they should practically be taught, by the example of their mother, not to require that personal attendance which it is an insult to humanity to require when in health. And instead of being led to assume airs of consequence, a sense of their own weakness should first make them feel the natural equality of man. Yet how frequently have I indignantly heard servants imperiously called to put children to bed, and being sent away again and again, because master or miss hung about mamma to stay a little longer. Thus made slavishly to attend the little idol, all those most disgusting humours were exhibited which characterize a spoiled child. In short, speaking of the majority of mothers, they leave their children entirely to the care of servants, or, because they are their children, treat them as if they were little demigods, though I have always observed that women who thus idolize their children seldom show common humanity to servants, or feel the least tenderness for any children but their own. It is, however, these exclusive affections, and an individual manner of seeing things, produced by ignorance, which keep women for ever at a stand with respect to improvement, and make many of them dedicate their lives to their children only to weaken their bodies and spoil their tempers, frustrating also any plan of education that a more rational father may adopt. For unless a mother concurs, the father who restrains will ever be considered as a tyrant. But, fulfilling the duties of a mother, a woman with a sound constitution may still keep her person scrupulously neat, and assist to maintain her family, if necessary, or, by reading and conversations with both sexes indiscriminately, improve her mind. For nature has so wisely ordered things, that did women suckle their children, they would preserve their own health, and there would be such an interval between the birth of each child, that we should seldom see a house full of babes. And did they pursue a plan of conduct, and not waste their time in following the fashionable vagaries of dress, the management of their household and children need not shut them out from literature, nor prevent their attaching themselves to a science with that steady eye which strengthens the mind, or practicing one of the fine arts that cultivate the taste. But visiting to display finery, card-playing, and balls, not to mention the idle bustle of morning trifling, draw women from their duty, to render them insignificant, to render them pleasing, according to the present acceptation of the word, to every man but their husband. For a round of pleasures in which the affections are not exercised cannot be said to improve the understanding, though it be erroneously called seeing the world. Yet the heart is rendered cold and averse to duty by such a senseless intercourse, which becomes necessary from habit, even when it has ceased to amuse. But, till more equality be established in society, till ranks are confounded and women freed, we shall not see that dignified domestic happiness, the simple grandeur of which cannot be relished by ignorant or vitiated minds, nor will the important task of education ever be properly begun till the person of a woman is no longer preferred to her mind. For it would be as wise to expect corn from tares, or figs from thistles, as that a foolish, ignorant woman should be a good mother. Section 13.6. It is not necessary to inform the sagacious reader, now I enter on my concluding reflections, that the discussion of this subject merely consists in opening a few simple principles, and clearing away the rubbish which obscured them. But as all readers are not sagacious, I must be allowed to add some explanatory remarks to bring the subject home to reason, to that sluggish reason which supinely takes opinions on trust and obstinately supports them to spare itself the labor of thinking. Moralists have unanimously agreed that unless virtue be nursed by liberty, it will never attain due strength, And what they say of man, I extend to mankind, insisting that in all cases morals must be fixed on immutable principles, and that the being cannot be termed rational or virtuous who obeys any authority but that of reason. To render women truly useful members of society, I argue that they should be led, by having their understandings cultivated on a large scale, to acquire a rational affection for their country, founded on knowledge, because it is obvious that we are little interested about what we do not understand. And to render this general knowledge of due importance, I have endeavoured to show that private duties are never properly fulfilled unless the understanding enlarges the heart, and that public virtue is only an aggregate of private. But the distinctions established in society undermine both by beating out the solid gold of virtue till it becomes only the tinsel covering of vice. For whilst wealth renders a man more respectable than virtue, wealth will be sought before virtue. And whilst women's persons are caressed when a childish simper shows an absence of mind, the mind will lie fallow. Yet true voluptuousness must proceed from the mind, for what can equal the sensations produced by mutual affection, supported by mutual respect? What are the cold or feverish caresses of appetite but sin embracing death, compared with the modest overflowings of a pure heart and exalted imagination? Yes, let me tell the libertine of fancy, when he despises understanding in woman, that the mind, which he disregards, gives life to the enthusiastic affection from which rapture, short-lived as it is, alone can flow, and that without virtue a sexual attachment must expire like a tallow candle in the socket, creating intolerable disgust. To prove this, I need only observe that men who have wasted great parts of their lives with women, and with whom they have sought for pleasure with eager thirst, entertain the meanest opinion of the sex. Virtue, true refiner of joy! If foolish men were to fright thee from the earth, in order to give loose to all their appetites without a check, some sensual wight of taste would scale the heavens to invite thee back, to give a zest to pleasure. That women at present are by ignorance rendered foolish or vicious is, I think, not to be disputed, and that the most salutary effects tending to improve mankind might be expected from a revolution in female manners appears at least, with a face of probability, to rise out of the observation. For as marriage has been termed the parent of those endearing charities which draw man from the brutal herd, the corrupting intercourse that wealth, idleness, and folly produce between the sexes is more universally injurious to morality than all the other vices of mankind collectively considered. To adulterous lust the most sacred duties are sacrificed, because before marriage men, by a promiscuous intimacy with women, learn to consider love as a selfish gratification, learn to separate it not only from esteem, but from the affection merely built on habit, which mixes a little humanity with it. Justice and friendship are also set at defiance, and that purity of taste is vitiated, which would naturally lead a man to relish an artless display of affection rather than affected airs. But that noble simplicity of affection, which dares to appear unadorned, has few attractions for the libertine, though it be the charm which, cementing the matrimonial tie, secures to the pledges of a warmer passion the necessary parental attention, for children will never be properly educated till friendship subsists between parents. virtue flies from a house divided against itself, and a whole legion of devils take up their residence there. The affection of husbands and wives cannot be pure when they have so few sentiments in common, and when so little confidence is established at home, as must be the case when their pursuits are so different. That intimacy from which tenderness should flow will not, cannot subsist between the vicious. Contending, therefore, that the sexual distinction which men have so warmly insisted upon is arbitrary, I have dwelt on an observation that several sensible men, with whom I have conversed on the subject, allowed to be well-founded, and it is simply this, that the little chastity to be found amongst men, and consequent disregard of modesty, tend to degrade both sexes, and further, that the modesty of women, characterized as such, will often be only the artful veil of wantonness, instead of being the natural reflection of purity, till modesty be universally respected. From the tyranny of man, I firmly believe, the greater number of female follies proceed, and the cunning, which I allow makes at present a part of their character, I likewise have repeatedly endeavoured to prove is produced by oppression. Were not dissenters, for instance, a class of people with strict truth characterized as cunning? And may I not lay some stress on this fact to prove that when any power but reason curbs the free spirit of man, dissimulation is practiced, and the various shifts of art are naturally called forth? Great attention to decorum, which was carried to a degree of scrupulosity, and all that puerile bustle about trifles and consequential solemnity which Butler's caricature of a dissenter brings before the imagination, shaped their persons as well as their minds in the mould of prim littleness. I speak collectively, for I know how many ornaments to human nature have been enrolled amongst sectaries. Yet I assert that the same narrow prejudice for their sect, which women have for their families, prevailed in the dissenting part of the community, however worthy in other respects, and also that the same timid prudence, or headstrong efforts, often disgraced the exertions of both. Oppression thus formed many of the features of their character perfectly to coincide with that of the oppressed half of mankind, for is it not notorious that dissenters were like women, fond of deliberating together and asking advice of each other, till by a complication of little contrivances some little end was brought about? A similar attention to preserve their reputation was conspicuous in the dissenting and female world, and was produced by a similar cause. Asserting the rights which women in common with men ought to contend for, I have not attempted to extenuate their faults, but to prove them to be the natural consequence of their education and station in society. If so, it is reasonable to suppose that they will change their character and correct their vices and follies when they are allowed to be free in a physical, moral, and civil sense. Let woman share the rights, and she will emulate the virtues of man, for she must grow more perfect when emancipated, or justify the authority that chains such a weak being to her duty. If the latter, it will be expedient to open a fresh trade with Russia for whips, a present which a father should always make to his son-in-law on his wedding day, that a husband may keep his whole family in order by the same means, and without any violation of justice reign, wielding this sceptre, sole master of his house, because he is the only being in it who has reason. The divine, indefeasible, earthly sovereignty breathed into man by the master of the universe. Allowing this position, women have not any inherent rights to claim, and by the same rule their duties vanish, for rights and duties are inseparable. Be just, then, O ye men of understanding, and mark not more severely what women do amiss than the vicious tricks of the horse or the ass for whom ye provide provender, and allow her the privileges of ignorance, to whom ye deny the rights of reason, or ye will be worse than Egyptian taskmasters, expecting virtue where nature has not given understanding. End of chapter 13b. End of book. A Vindication of the Rights of Woman by Mary Wollstonecraft.